So, to begin with, I'll invite anybody to who has a question or something on their mind. Yes.
It's not as much of a question, but just continuing with the theme of what you were talking about earlier, the doer and so forth. I was wondering if maybe you could elaborate on when you're meditating, if you could elaborate on the sense of either surrender, letting go, being, as opposed to doing. Because I think when we're meditating so often, we feel like we have to go somewhere or get somewhere. We're trying to get to a certain point that's ahead of us, particularly with all these maps that are given, like the 10 stages and stages of Vipassana and graduated path and so forth. I think it's very easy to get caught in this feeling that you're moving forward instead of releasing and surrendering into and letting go.
Yes, yes.
Of misperception.
Yes, that's true. There is, you know, there is a developmental aspect to meditation practice. You know, the 10 stages, the 18 knowledges of the insight path, and all of these different things. And they're very helpful, because they do give you a map. And the most important thing about a map is you can use it to figure out where you are and what you should do next. So that's really, that's the value of a map. And where it becomes a problem is where we start reacting to it by feeling like we should be making progress, we should be somewhere we're not. Or looking at what we're doing and being critical of it, you know, and, oh, well, I'm not doing very well because I'm only practicing at this level, and I, you know, by now I should be practicing at this level. And all of that, every bit of that, creates a problem. And so you actually need to be aware of that your mind is going to do that. As a matter of fact, even without the maps, your mind would do that. Even without a map to go by, you would still be telling yourself stories about how you're doing compared to how you did before, how you're doing compared to what it looks like other people are doing, or sounds like if they talk about it. So it's just something that is going to go on in your mind. And if you have a map of where you're going, then it's going to be focused on that. But the thing is that one of the things that you need to discover in the process of meditation is that there is no self that's in charge of your mind. So you aren't training your mind. Your mind is training itself. And this seems like, you know, this seems like an odd way of looking at things at first, but at some point you'll come to realize just how true that is, and that's one of those important insights when it comes along. And of course, in terms of the stages of insight, you can't make yourself have an insight. You can read about it, you can study about it, you can listen to people talk about realizing that this view that I have of myself as being somebody that's doing and in charge, you can't have an insight into the truth of that just by thinking about it, just by knowing about it, or just by wanting to. Although you can probably fool yourself for a little while, not for very long. And it's the same way with the stages of samatha, although they're, it's much, much harder to fool yourself, because the stages of samatha are describing a behavior of a mind that has been successfully trained, and the result of that training is that the mind behaves in a very different way than it usually does. So you can't really fool yourself very long. But the problem comes when you start being evaluative, judging, becoming attached to goals, becoming attached to your progress. There's one thing about the meditation progress is it's not completely linear. I mean, you start off at the beginning and you do eventually achieve something. You do eventually accomplish something. But along the way, it's you know, you move ahead, you move back, you go back and forth. And over time, you're steadily becoming, you're steadily improving the skills that are involved. And in terms of insight, you are steadily having a deeper and deeper realization of the way things really are, the way your mind really is. So there is that kind of progress. But it's of a nature that immediately becomes very difficult if you start keeping score with yourself. Because you do, you move forward and you move back. Something happens in your life and you may move way back. And then you'll sit down and you'll have those times that for some reason or another you're having experiences that, you know, you look and say, oh, well, that's a very advanced experience. And of course you want to be able to do that every time. It's wonderful. Most of these more advanced experiences are really pleasurable, enjoyable, amazing, impressive, and they elicit an attachment and a desire to chase after them. I want to have that again. But all of these things are actually going to stand in your way. To the degree that you slip into that mindset of judging yourself, rating your accomplishment, and things like that, it's actually going to slow you down. It really will. Because that the mind's a subtle thing, but when we're training the mind, part of the training is to train that part of the mind that makes these kinds of judgments to be quiet and get out of the way. And to the extent that it doesn't do that, it gets in the way of your meditation. So if you sit down to practice and you have this attachment to the way your practice was yesterday or the way you think it should be, it's not going to be as good because the very part of your mind that is creating that desire, that attachment, is the very part of your mind that's going to get in the way of it happening. So, but I mean, we could say, and some people have said, well, we'd be better off without maps. You'd be better off not knowing. I mean, this is the Zen approach. Sit down, stare at the wall, and if you stare long enough, something will happen. Don't ask me to explain what's happening or what you should do next. All you should do next is go sit down and stare at the wall some more. And that is, that's an approach that avoids being attached to making progress on a particular map. But it doesn't change what's happening. The quality of your meditation still gets better and slips back. And an ordinary person still gets attached every time they have a really good zazen sit, and they still get upset at themselves when they don't, when they're falling asleep over and over again or their mind's full of distractions. So it's really best to just recognize the problem and to accept it and to deal with it and to try to overcome it. As I was saying earlier, to the degree that you feel like your meditation is hard or difficult, you need to look at what's going on in your mind. You need to look at what's going on in your mind for two reasons. One, you're going to learn some really interesting things. By looking, it's going to move you in the direction of insight. But the other thing is, by looking at what's going on in your mind, you can understand how you are creating your own problems. So when you're feeling like meditation is really hard, mm-hmm. or if it's time for you to do your daily practice and you find that there's a resistance, I don't really want to do this, it's not much fun, it's hard, this is an opportunity. Look inside and see what you're doing with that. The meditation instructions themselves, I'll say it again, they're extremely simple. They are so simple. All you do is put your attention on the meditation object. And if and when it goes somewhere else, just bring it back. There's nothing could be simpler. That doesn't take much energy at all. It's when you put your attention on the meditation object and it goes somewhere and you feel annoyed at yourself because your attention went somewhere else. And then you bring it back and then you clench in and say, okay, I'm going to keep it here this time. You know, that's hard. But that's not really, that's none of that is part of the meditation instruction. You know, that's not how you keep your mind from wandering. That's not the way. There is a way, there's a method, there's techniques that you practice, and they're all very simple. They all involve doing really the only things that you can, which is putting intention behind what happens in terms of the movements of attention and what you're aware of, you know, the broader awareness within which that attention takes place. So the acts of meditation themselves are very simple, but we make them difficult. And there's actually a thing that the ego does too. It's nice if you can recognize when it happens. If you have this idea that you should be able to do such and such in your meditation, and you don't succeed, the ego part of your mind wants to blame someone. Well, the ego part of your mind that likes to believe it's in control is first going to blame itself. How come I wasn't able to do that? It doesn't matter that part of your mind can't do it anyway. It's absolutely impossible. It's so used to taking credit for everything that happens that it's going to take the blame in this case for your meditation not progressing the way you thought it was supposed to. You know, you learned to meditate, you sat down the first few weeks, boy, you were doing really great, you were making great progress, you were sure that you were going to achieve samatha, you were going to become awakened, and, you know, by Christmas for sure. it doesn't happen. So what your ego wants to do then is it doesn't want the self to be at fault. It doesn't want it to be your fault. And so it creates this feeling of trying hard. Your ego will generate the emotion of striving. And you'll feel all this striving. And what this does, when you've strived really hard for a whole hour, and if you still didn't succeed, well, it's not my fault. I really tried. Right? So there's that kind of trickery that goes on in your mind as well. But the problem is always coming from the same thing. It's your mind isn't a thing, it's many things. Your mind is sort of self-directing, self-creating as a whole, but there's no one part of your mind that's in charge. And because we were talking about a storyteller earlier, because of that particular part of your mind that's always telling you the story of what's happening, then there's this illusion that there is, you know, that there must be some part of your mind that's in control. Because, after all, the story has a hero. I did this, I did that, everything else. And so that imaginary, fictional self that doesn't exist, what really exists is in any given moment, some part of your mind may generate a strong intention, and what happens in terms of your behavior or your speech or just where your attention goes when you're meditating, something will happen as a result of that intention. And for the moment, that's the I. But a moment later, a different part of your mind with a different intention will cause something else to happen. Or we'll judge just what just happened, either one. So you can experience an internal conflict, different parts of your mind arguing about what you should or shouldn't do, one part of your mind criticizing you, which is really the you that one part of your mind is criticizing, is some other part of your mind. Or judging, or all of these different things are going on in different parts of your mind. There is no one that's in control. So your meditation task is a little bit like herding cats. You're trying to get all these different parts of your mind to start working together and going in the same direction. Yes, Chris.
Given everything you've said here, and a lot of the things that you've said in previous lectures that I can't really recap quickly, I just want to know how you... It sounds like we can't ever live a life of purpose, this intention, and I mean, how do you ever get a long-term goal going? Like, I think I'll go get a degree. Mm-hmm. There's some portion of me that is generating that intention, and it's a storyteller, and
yeah. Now the storyteller never generates an intention. Intention comes from somewhere else.
Sheila Dawson, is your recorder on?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah, the storyteller just tells the story. Some other part of your mind has generated the intention. When you have a major long-term goal, the only way it will happen is if many different parts of your mind have all agreed on that goal, and each is contributing in its own way to sustaining the attention and causing that to happen. But as I'm sure you've experienced yourself, even those long-term goals that are strongly held and that you've succeeded at, mm-hmm. if you kind of examine what's happened moment by moment, day after day, there's always been other parts of your mind that hadn't bought into it totally. You know, would rather skip this, do something else. Or sometimes you have those days when you just want to throw it all up, you know, and quit the whole thing. But yeah, the storyteller only tells a story. It's like, think of the storyteller part of your mind. It's sort of like a secretary at a board meeting and writes the minutes of the meeting, you know. The minutes get all converted into quarterly reports and annual reports and everything like that. And they all talk as though there is some single entity that things are happening to and that's doing things. But that's not really the case. It's just a description of what happened, and in order to make sense of it and to make it flow and to link one event with another, you know, it's just the story is around, for most of us, it's around a single person. But there are some people who there's an internal fracturing and they get several different stories going. You know? And so... One, you know, the story that gets told is, well, that other part of me did this. It wasn't me, and it's seen as different. And then the extreme form is you have multiple personalities. Sometimes they'll even deny the existence of each other. But all of that is just showing you, I mean, if you look inside your own mind, that's exactly what's going on in your mind, too. We all have multiple personalities. It's just they're not as completely fractured as they are in some individuals who have to deal with a more difficult situation. Yeah.
Then it's the storyteller part of your mind that is utilized during with some meditation techniques like, you know, hearing out, hearing in, you know, that's monitoring, you know, nanosecond by nanosecond what's going on. It's the storyteller part of the mind, again, that's that you're utilizing for that technique, would you say?
Well,
and is it beneficial? Does it help the storyteller?
Yes, we need to. I don't know how deeply we want to get into this, but okay, there's a series of mind states. Each one is very brief, and each one has its own content, and by themselves. They would be, you know, an example that comes to mind, they'd be like the notes to a piece of music. And how do you recognize a melody? if one note's completely over with before the next note is played, somebody's playing with one finger at a time on a piano or something, you can recognize the melody. How does that happen? Well, when you hear the third or the fourth note, you still have this reverberation in your mind, this recollection of the notes that went before, and you recognize the melody. What's happening in your mind is that there are many different mental states being generated in rapid succession. And the function of, you know, what I'm calling the storyteller, the narrator, its absolutely essential function that you could not get by without, is it captures a sequence of moments of consciousness and it holds them, makes them into a larger picture, so to speak. And then it projects it back into consciousness, and the rest of your mind looks at it and says, ah, okay, that's what we did. And this is happening constantly. So what I'm calling the narrator is actually a mental function that you absolutely cannot do without. It's taking and storing chunks of information. Not only that, the storyteller part of your mind, it can take, for example, it could take a dozen of these mental states in a row, makes them into a chunk, and then projects it back. But it's the one that's always storing them. So what it can do is it can take a series of these chunks, each one of them containing 12 moments of consciousness, and assemble them into a larger picture, and a larger picture, and a larger picture. What we tune in on depends on what's happening in the moment. If you're watching something that's happening very quickly, then part of that is going to be, you're going to be aware of small chunks. Most of the time, though, we're satisfied with just being conscious of larger chunks of what the storyteller has to tell us about what's going on. So it's a normal function of the mind. It's always happening. And yes, you can use it. Yes, meditation practice, all these different meditation practices involve using different parts of your mind in different ways. And the purpose of it is, well, sometimes it's to achieve a particular goal in meditation, but the larger purpose of meditation is to bring you to a place where you have the kind of mind that can understand what's really going on. It can understand itself, it can understand its nature of reality, and that's where the insight comes from. So a very important part of the meditation process and an important part of insight is becoming aware of how this part of your mind works. But when we talk about it on a daily basis, we realize that we have these stories about who we are that we tend to believe. And if you examine them closely, which if you go to see a therapist, the therapist will help you to examine them closely, and you realize a lot of these stories just, they don't match up, they don't make sense. You ask the question, well, how could I have all these different conflicting stories about who I am and what I am going on at the same time? And we basically believe we are our stories. And in any given situation, one story of who you are is going to be pulled up, and that's going to predominate. And so just getting a handle on the stories you tell yourself is a really powerful thing. There is one teacher, I can't remember her name, but that's her whole thing. One of her books is Where Would You Be Without Your Story? Does anybody know who?
Byron Katie.
What's that?
Byron Katie.
Byron Katie, yes, Byron Katie. And it's really marvelous, the work she does, and that's what she called it, the work. It's the work of examining the stories that you live by. And that's sort of at the macro level, of seeing the stories that you live by and how they make you, how they basically create your life as you're going along. But this, what I'm talking to you about, this isn't some fanciful thing, some theoretical thing. No, it's something that you discover directly in the experience as a result of your meditation practice. But it even has more objective substantiation than that. There is an area in the left hemisphere that its whole job is to tell a story that makes sense of whatever's happening in the moment. And if you've heard about the split brain patients who they have the two hemispheres separated, cutting all the nerve bundles that connect the right and left side of the brain. And a lot of research was done on those split brain patients. And of course, the left side of the brain is where most people have their speech centers. And it's possible for an experimenter to communicate with the two sides of the brain independently of each other, send information to one half that the other half can't get. And of course, whatever they say verbally is generated by the left side of the brain. So if the experimenter causes the right side of the brain to produce some action, the left side of the brain has no idea why it was done. But if the experimenter asks the patient, they'll tell them a very plausible story for why you did that. But they really don't know at all. It's called confabulation. And it's the naked storyteller. It's the naked storyteller. But you know, I think all of you have recognized, you've had many opportunities in your life to recognize that this storyteller function is taking place. And it's a very important thing. Its function is crucial to your survival, but it's also highly problematic. I can't remember how I got started on that.
Labeling.
What's that?
She asked about labeling. Labeling uses the storytelling part. If it helps.
Well, it uses that part of your mind that conceptualizes and labels and integrates. You see, you have, if you examine your experiences as they arise, there is a raw sensory experience that you'll have with one of your senses. And the part of your mind, the part of your brain mind that's responsible for that kind of sensory input will do a certain amount of processing of that information. But it's not very conceptual. It becomes a mental representation, but it's not highly conceptualized. It's a different part of your mind that takes that information and figures out a context for it and actually creates a story around why you saw or heard or whatever, something that you just did. You know, if there's a red shape outside your window, the sensory part of your mind will go as far as saying there's a red bird, but there's another part of your mind that will analyze it and give it a label. It's a cardinal. So there is always this movement of the mind back and forth between relatively minimally processed information that is made conscious by one part of the brain, and then information that is no longer raw, that is highly processed, and it becomes full-blown with a story and all kinds of connections with it. You know, maybe you hate cardinals. That's part of, you know, what that part of the mind says. Oh, there's one of those cardinals I hate. Maybe I hate a cardinal. But it's very conceptual and abstract. So when you do a practice that where you're constantly labeling, you're forcing the mind to move more quickly between two different modes of operation. As soon as something stands out in your awareness, then your attention goes to that and engages this part of your mind over here that conceptualizes it and gives it a label. And then if you're doing the practice properly, as soon as you've given it a label and you don't need to hold on to it anymore, you go back to looking to see what else is out there. Mm-hmm. So what happens is you're training your mind to switch back and forth between these two modes very, very quickly. And it's a way of training your mind so that it can recognize impermanence. It can recognize that arising and passing away of sensory phenomena, and at the same time the arising and passing away of mental phenomena. So it leads to a profound experience of everything's impermanent, everything's changing.
So are you in a kind of a maladaptive loop, so to speak? If you're meditating, you're aware that a thought comes up, and then instead of saying, this is a thought, and moving on to see what else is out there, you start to judge it.
Yeah.
Then that's where you get stuck.
Yeah.
In some kind of a loop that prevents you from going on to the next fresh thing.
That's right.
It's
exactly.
In your mind. Is that,
that's exactly right. And that's
so,
what.
So in meditation, as Shelley was saying, then when you get into this loop, what do?
Yeah. When you get into that loop, you've lost mindfulness, you've lost
right.
attentional stability, you've got lost in a thought process.
Right.
And, of course, when that happens and it persists for several seconds or longer, you're quite aware of it. But it's actually happening on a very fine scale as well. But what you're trying to do is to train your mind to not to get lost and carried away with processing things, but
and
just be here with what's happening.
Not blaming yourself for doing that.
Not blaming yourself for doing it. That's right. You can't see what's really there if you've taken an abstract representation of that and made it an object of judgment.
I found one trick to getting out of that loop is focusing on some impermanent quality about whatever you're stuck in. That if you expect it, you know, if you expect it to pass, then it will pass more quickly, I found.
If you expect it to pass, it passes more quickly.
But, you know, you've noticed this quality of impermanence in other things, and so you look for that quality of impermanence in this thing, and then you can usually find it pretty quickly, and then it moves away much faster.
Well, what one of the things that happens is that instead of whenever a thought comes along being captured by it, you maintain a certain perspective so that you see that it's there, but you don't need to be caught by the content of it. And that's
or the feelings attached.
Or the feelings. You can be aware of the feelings. It doesn't mean that the feelings aren't there.
Oh,
but it means that okay, you see the feelings arise and you see them pass away, but you don't need to process that information. You don't need to worry about, oh,
that's
no.
That's another story.
Yeah, this feeling's going to last and ruin my whole meditation.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's the kind of thing that you do, that you naturally tend to do. So you're training, if you're practicing properly, you're doing a lot of different things, the result of which is going to be that you don't get caught up so easily, you don't judge yourself, all these other things. But if you realize that your mind's going to be trying to do that, because that's its habit that it's always had, then you have an advantage, because now you can notice when that's part of the dynamic, and you can not judge that part of the dynamic too. And if you don't, if you see that you're, you know, you could listen to what I'm saying and say, okay, if I'm striving and making that meditation hard, it's because I'm doing things that I shouldn't do. And so the next time you meditate and you find you can beat yourself up mentally for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
sure. Sure you could.
Instead, it's just let it come, let it be, let it go. It really is. Yeah.
I just love what you said once about how when the mind wanders, beating ourselves up is telling the mind not to notice itself wandering, because
yes.
when it does, it gets beat up. Whereas positively reinforcing it and being excited about noticing the mind wander tells the mind that noticing is good.
Yeah.
And I just love that.
And that is such an important and valuable thing to learn. So, positive, in general, positive reinforcement works much better in terms of training your mind than does negative reinforcement. Because all these different parts of your mind have too many clever ways of hiding.
I think this has a real implication for our relationships with others and the way we move in the world. Because when we notice how incredibly mercurial our own minds are, then, you know, because I think when we look externally from ourselves, we assign certain characteristics to people. You know, they're behaving like this, and that's the way they are. You know, and things sort of concretize in terms of attitudes of other people. But I've been noticing that it's really helping. Noticing how mercurial I am inside is helping me understand, well, it's just a wave, you know. Their behavior in the moment is just a wave. It too will pass. Let it come, let it be, let it go. I break out into song. It really helps.
You're amazing.
It is really true that everything that you learn about yourself and your own life becomes applicable to everyone that you're around and the situations that you're in. You know, and in the Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra, where the Buddha is talking about mindfulness of the body, and the body, feelings and the feeling, mental states and phenomena and phenomena, he repeats over and over again that you examine, you see this in yourself, then you see this in other people, and then you see this in both yourself and other people, and it dramatically changes the way you react to what other people do. And it's really the same process. Like, you, all this change is taking place, and you have this inner tendency to judge yourself and everything else. You're doing the same thing with other people. And when you start to see, when you start to realize that behind their actions and behind their words is a mind just like yours that is so, mercurial, and just that, you know, then you stop reacting to them as though they were this solid entity that's in this way that you can be judgmental of. You start to understand everything better. And of course, the other advantage there too is, you know, there are things that no matter how hard we try, we can't really see clearly when we look at ourselves. But when we look at somebody else, we can see those things. And if we've been doing this kind of training, when we see it in somebody else, we know it's happening in us too. So we learn something that we couldn't otherwise. Yeah.
We have a lot of wonderful descriptive language for describing how we are right now with this untrained mind that we're training. Mm-hmm. And there is this suggestion you've given about how it will be when our minds are trained, like there's a goal. But aside from that, if I were to wake up tomorrow exquisitely trained and see all of these things, is there any language for that? All this language for how we are before we get there, and I don't know any words for the trained mind being like that, whatever that is.
Well, it's actually easier for someone with that kind of mind to describe than it is for somebody without that kind of mind to understand what they're saying.
Oh. Okay, I'm done.
But if there were more people doing that, then the available language would definitely improve. And as the language improves and gets clearer, then more and more people who've had inklings of that will be able to understand what they're talking about.
Yeah, that was kind of where I thought I might be going until you mentioned that it's not going to connect if there's nothing to connect it to.
Well, because we try to interpret everything in terms of our own experience? I mean, we have to. What other choice do we have?
Yeah.
You know, and so to explain to you something that you never experienced, the only thing somebody else can do is to try to find two or three other things that are somewhat similar that they're pretty sure you have experienced, and speak to you in such a way that you can see an analogy well enough to get a grasp of what it's saying. But even if it's put in the clearest possible terms, language is flexible enough that what you're going to hear is what you're primed to hear. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting thing that I find. I give these Dharma talks, and sometimes people come up to me afterwards and they tell me what they heard. You know, the wonderful thing is that most of the time they've heard what they needed to hear, and it's good for them. It works really, really well for them. But from my side, I'm thinking, wow, I wish I'd said that, but I didn't.
So then when someone comes back to you and says, wow, that was a really cool thing I heard you say, you get to hear a whole new thing.
I get to hear a whole new thing. And what the experience that I have is that, not that, oh boy, I did a really good job, it's that we were working together and we got something accomplished that's wonderful. I was dancing my half of the dance, they were dancing their half of the dance, and it worked. And it makes it easier for a person not to get caught up in self-congratulatoriness and their own ego and things like that, if they can realize that, yeah, you know, it's a dynamic interaction in a sense. As you come to understand your own mind as being an assemblage of different mental processes without a self in it, then you realize that the group of us in a room like this, we're actually like a larger mind, you know, and we're working together. And the wonderful thing is that as a result of our interactions, we can come up with things that none of us would generate on our own. And just one of the many forms that takes is, I'll say something with one thing in mind, but somebody else will hear what they need to hear to understand something that they've been struggling with. And the end result is both of us are further ahead. So it's a marvelous thing that happens.
I find that mind is most present to me when we're meditating.
Yeah.
That communion, completely silent, but I feel a mind, a bigger mind.
Yeah. How many people find it easier to meditate in a group? Isn't that an interesting thing?
One of the things that I only recently have started to observe is that in exactly the same way that sometimes when I'm meditating by myself and it's more easy or it's less easy or it's, oh, this was a good one, this wasn't, sorry, oops, judgmental, but there it is. The quality of a group meditation can similarly be out of kilter a little or and sometimes you come in and it's like this well-oiled machine. And you can feel that presence in the room. Sometimes then if you arrive late and you know it's entirely about you anyway, you come in and you say, oh, they can hear the clatter in my head. I have to shut this off. I'll be disturbing my friends. Okay, go.
Yeah, don't worry.
Thank you.
Yes.
I've been saying this mantra in my brain. I've got it on a magnet stuck to my refrigerator, but I'm not sure what it means. It's Omi, Mani, Padme, Boom. What does it mean?
It means basically the jewel in the lotus.
Oh, okay. Somebody told me it was my mind stuck in my head.
Om is the seed syllable for the universal, for everything, for the whole, home. And Hung is the seed syllable for the self. In the other words, Mani Padme Hung, or Mani Padme of the jewel in the lotus. So that's what it literally means.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it has a nice meaning.
Yes.
It also has a wonderful sound, and you know, it's one of those mantras that you can get it going in your head. It can be very, very soothing. It can help you to focus. Yeah.
We can chant that next week.
Okay. We could chant it tonight.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we could.
How does intention contrast with expectation?
How does intention
contrast with expectation?
Contrast? Well, there is a relationship between the two, because your expectations are reflections of intentions. But intention itself is it's basically the most fundamental movement of the mind, or of any part of the mind. And so the more of your mind clearly and strongly holds the same intention, then the more perfectly that intention is acted upon. But if some other part of your mind begins to set itself apart and abstracts what's going on and creates an expectation, then it's not actually contributing to the intention anymore. What it's doing is judging the outcome. So, and you know, that's a normal thing to happen, because the way we function in the world is we have projects that require a series of steps. So our mind has to be capable of generating expectations so that we can fulfill these various functions. And so there's always this interaction between intentions and expectations. But it's when expectation gets out of control, so to speak, when it's no longer just providing direction for the next set of intentions, but now it's judging what's happened and trying to make things happen, which you can't really do. Yes?
So it's more like a distraction then?
Expectations, well, expectations, yes, they can be major distractions, and they are. Well, for example, if you're engaging in some kind of activity, a physical activity that involves a certain degree of skill, when you're learning that activity, expectation is playing a useful role, and so expectation generates the target, and then you attempt to do it, play the tune, hit the ball, whatever it is, and you keep repeating that, and you get better and better at it. Once that skill has become refined so that it unfolds automatically, you'll notice, and I know everyone here has noticed that, as soon as expectation gets in there, it interrupts, it blocks, it is a distraction. It interrupts the smooth flow of what's happening.
It happens with language production a lot. If you're trying to speak a foreign language, the minute you start thinking about it or have expectations, you clam up and can't speak.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Even if you have whatever level of fluency you have acquired.
I know what you mean. I know what you mean. And I think what you can probably all see in both of these examples is there's one part of your mind that knows how to do it, and left on its own, it will do it. It's when another part of your mind that's not capable of doing it tries to get involved. You know, it can only... This is... Part of the reason for that is that, as I said, your mind involves a series of mental states following one right after another. And so something like that interrupts the flow.
Which goes back to the original idea that doing is always happening. It's when the mind tries to impose this doer that it kind of like is that other part that can trip things up.
Yeah, that's right. This doer that somehow thinks it can do what it can never do.
Mm-hmm. I had a bit of a connection. I was thinking about expectation, and I was thinking about a hypothesis, and the similarity between them. A hypothesis is like an expectation, except if you're not, you know, attached to the outcome, it can, you know, help you learn about a model or a system.
A hypothesis is an expectation you've learned not to be attached to.
Yeah.
or at least that you try to begin to be attached to. Which is why null hypotheses work best. Because if your real hypothesis is not what you're actually testing, if you're actually testing something that would negate your hypothesis, then it helps. Yeah.
And you'll never get promoted.
You do that, you get a degree, you get published, grants. Okay, well, it's past 8:30, so I think we should probably...